Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
Borders seem to be all over the news lately. You've got trade wars, Brexit, and of course, Trump's wall. This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring how borders are created and blurred in the world of food.
We try to focus a lot on the fact that they are chefs by nature, that the refugee thing is just a status for them.
And after the Soviet space ended, I don't think there was much research. It was all considered just Soviet food or Russian food. And I don't think it gives a lot of those cultures credit.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to HRN Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is Bushwick. I'm Kat Johnson, the Communications Director at Heritage Radio Network, and Katie is out once again this week, but I am joined by Hannah Forden, our Program Manager.
Happy Thursday. Happy rainy, gray, but sort of spring-like Thursday.
It's kind of nice to be in the studio when it's raining, though.
It's cozy,
mm-hmm.
And there's, like, you know, mood lighting, and we get to watch people eat pizza.
Drink fancy wine. There's a fancy wine thing happening at Roberta's. I would highly recommend coming to that. Looks great. We have our engineer, Jeet, in the booth. Hello, Jeet. He's waving. He's our quiet engineer.
Hello.
There he is. And our guests today, we're very excited. They're longtime friends of the network. We have Kate Cox and Joe Fassler from the New Food Economy. Welcome, guys.
Hey. Yeah,
glad to be
Thank
here.
You.
You guys have been on the radio before, but we're very excited to have you on Happy Hour for the first time.
We're psyched to be here. Great. I didn't kind of know this was a thing, and now I feel resentful that we didn't do happy hour every other time that we were on the radio.
I have a glass of beautiful orange wine in my hand, and I'm very happy.
Yes, happy hour is always accompanied with a happy-making beverage.
Absolutely.
It's working.
Mm-hmm. It's helpful.
We're going to talk a lot about New Food Economy, and this is a happy hour where we're going to have a little bit of like heavier topics, but it's still going to be very happy to me because I am always fascinated by everything that the New Food Economy is putting out there. It's one of my go-to places to find out what's going on in the world of food and how everything on my plate is affected by politics and weather and a myriad of other factors in the world. So we're going to get to that in just a moment. First, I have a quick announcement. We've been saying it a little bit, but Taste Washington is coming up on March 28th through 31st. It's going to be in Seattle. And if you're there at Taste Washington, look out for our own Katie Mosman-Wadler and Sam Ben Ruby, the host of The Great Nation. They are going to be on hand to interview some winemakers, drink some wine, and go up to them and ask them all about Heritage Radio Network. We're excited to be doing some West Coast stuff. Yeah. All right, so next up we have a few of our headlines, and Hannah's going to kick it off.
Okay, so earlier today, one of our amazing former interns and food studies graduate, Claire Alsup, was the guest on A Taste of the Past with Linda Palaccio. They talked about Claire's in-depth study of Colatura di Alici, an Italian fish sauce made with fermented anchovies. And until the 1990s, the product had never been bottled or sold, but now there's global demand for this super local specialty. And Claire spent several months in Sitara, a small town on the Amalfi Coast, examining the history and process of Colatura di Alici, which I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation of. And she was sort of thrust into the middle of this small town's debate. So that's going to be super interesting. Be sure to tune into that if you're a food history buff.
On a special episode and highly caffeinated episode of Life's a Banquet, Breton and Zara were joined by Dana Cowan of HRN Speaking Broadly. They talked about all things coffee, and they learn about the woman who was behind the invention of the coffee filter. Another angle of food history, if you like food history, is Life's a Banquet. Don't miss out on that. They also ate tiramisu on air, which Hannah got to have some of after the show.
It was so good. I was really hungry. We were gearing up for our ladies' night party, and I got like a little sugar and caffeine buzz, which was very well needed and very delicious. And this week on The Speakeasy, we meet author and spirits educator and consultant Shannon Mustafer. They talk about her book, Tiki Tropical Cocktails, which debuted on March 19th. And she shared with Southern Damon her thoughts about the craft, finding and cultivating your own voice, and of course, the most important ingredient in tiki drinks, rum.
At the top of the show, you heard a little bit about our current episode of Meet and Three that's out about borders. And I just wanted to tease that tomorrow we have a new episode dropping. It's a little bit different than other episodes of Meet and Three, where we have very different stories that are thematically linked. Tomorrow, we went on a trip to Newark recently, and tomorrow our show is about our trip to Newark. There's a lot more going on in Newark than you might imagine. There's indoor farming. There's the most incredible school lunch program that I've ever seen. There is total like food and beverage nerds that are doing some incredible things. That's all I'm going to say. Tune in tomorrow. You'll never see Newark the same way again.
Yeah, Newark might be the future for all of us, which is something I never thought I would be this excited about.
Kate and Joe are thumbs upping. What, you guys have thoughts about Newark?
Maybe not. Well, first of all, they have an incredible row of Portuguese restaurants, like right off the train, right?
We went there. We went
fabulous.
We went to Caseria e Bom, I believe that's how you say it.
If that's the one that people go to, I think that's probably the one.
It's like a charcuterie shop.
Yes.
Oh,
incredible seafood on that stretch. So, and you know, Aero Farms is there and that, mm-hmm. that ginormous facility. But I think Joe and I are always looking for a way to afford to live on the East Coast. So, you know, there's always like a range of, a range of cities in play there. Newark? Sure.
It was very, so we went to visit Gil, who runs All Points West Distillery. I'm giving away a little bit more, but he's fascinating and is just a total, the most knowledgeable person about spirits and the historical link between Europe and American spirits. And he talks so much about how he was living in New Orleans for so long, but that he loves Newark because it has in some way some of the same feel of like a mid-sized city, and that he's very close to New York. And the reference, All Points West Distillery, is a reference to the original like train terminal that most Ellis Island immigrants would have gone to in Newark and then dispersed throughout the country. So very interesting stories to be told in Newark. And we have four of them, and I'm sure there are a lot more. Yeah.
Ooh, it's going to be such a good episode.
I'm very excited. All right. Those are our headlines. Next up, Kate and Joe. Kate is the editor and Joe is the features editor. Is that the correct titles, guys?
Sure.
Yeah.
At New Food Economy. Let's just start off, since you haven't been on Happy Hour before. Tell us, what is the New Food Economy, and what can people expect to find on the website?
So let's see. Okay, first, newfoodeconomy.org. We'll get that out of the way. Tick that box right off. So we're a nonprofit newsroom. We're based in New York City. We have a staff of 7 reporters and editors, actually soon to be 10. We're starting to grow, which is wonderful. And we investigate the forces shaping how and what we eat. So exactly what you said as we started talking, which is that we look at the politics, the power, the money behind our plates and make those connections for readers. And we write a lot of news because food makes a lot of news right now, mm-hmm. Whether that's policy or natural disasters or federal food assistance. We're kind of all up
disease.
In it. Yeah, or zombie deer disease.
Yeah,
okay, zombie deer disease.
I'm going to make a plug
for that.
Yeah,
I'm going to make a plug for that story because it's crazy. It was written by our staff writer, H. Claire Brown. And it is actually a phenomenon that's affecting deer out in the Midwest and the West. And I forget if it's a pathogen.
It's similar to mad cow. It's a prion-based disease affects the brain.
Makes
these deer act crazy.
So I have a confession to make. I, on 2 occasions in my life, have eaten like venison heart, raw venison heart, tartare. It's a superstition thing. I won't go into it. But after eating them one time, it was like a couple years ago, and it was like a terrible flu season. And I think I just got like the flu, but thought like I had gotten zombie deer disease from like eating raw deer.
Oh, I can understand how you would have made that mental leap. The good thing to know is, even though it's
fascinating. I feel like I'm getting it just sitting here.
We might actually
it's
have
it. It's airborne. We've all had it this whole time.
We're sitting in a little shipping container. Actually, humans, it cannot be transmitted that way from deer to human. Although, fair enough that you were concerned about that.
Well, that's a relief. I don't want to be a zombie deer.
No, we don't want to be a zombie deer. And it's a very tragic and awful and swift death for affected animals. Oh. And they do sort of drool and get crazy-eyed, and I think that's where they get the name from.
Yeah, there's stories of them just like running around in circles around people's houses and stuff. Like, they get crazy.
It's quite distressing.
Wow.
And I will say that in the world of It Bleeds, If It Bleeds, It Leads, our version of that is the zombie deer story, because that story drove so much traffic to this website. I can't tell you anything with zombies.
I think people were just frantically Googling it and being like,
Gotta know what this is.
You just get the Walking Dead crowd that's like, oh, finally.
Right, that keyword.
Speaking of meat, making a real big jump from venison to other types of meat, but tell us about the upcoming event you have, the Meat Summit.
Sure. So we are doing a summit called Raising Meat at Texas A&M University in... The program is really April 1st, April Fool's Day Summit we've got going on.
Oh, boy.
And basically, this is really to explore, the process of raising meat in the 21st century. So we're kicking it off in grand fashion with a kind of, conversation between, someone representing regenerative grass-based ranching, a kind of more conventional, grain-based approach, and then a cell-cultured guy. And then we're just going to let them kind of have it out on stage and then go from there, through all these other topics of animal husbandry, antibiotics, media, and how the media talks about meat. We're going to try to kind of hit all the buttons. So we're really looking forward to it. It's the first summit we've done. Texas is always a good time. And, Texas A&M has one of the best sort of meat science departments in the country. So we're excited to have some participation from the faculty there.
Yeah, because Texas A&M is a land-grant university, and we could talk a little bit about land grants and, like, the historical implications there, but there are kind of, there are people on both sides of it that are, like, there's so much good work being done by extension programs at land grants, but also they, in many ways, do kind of push forward, like, big ag in some cases. So why was it important for you guys to do this program specifically at a land-grant university and include people working there in this conversation about meat?
That's a good question. Why did we want to do this, Joe?
Yeah.
First of all, it had a lot to do with location, right? Mm-hmm. So even though we're based in New York, we have a pretty significant readership in the middle part of the country. We have a good Texas readership. And so we wanted to be closer in conversation to the people who are growing the food we're talking about. I think it was a challenge in some senses, right? Whether we could host a conversation like the kinds that we have on our pages all the time, that brought lots of stakeholders into the conversation, but to have it at a traditionally large-scale agriculture-focused school. And I won't lie, it's been challenging to put it together. There's a lot of deeply held positions. There's pretty intense politics. And we keep persisting in having this meat conversation because, frankly, our readers are interested. And the meat processing sector, production, all of it is somewhat enigmatic. And I think people are deeply, deeply curious about what it means to eat meat in this country today. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, let's go to the center point of that conversation and see if we can lure people there that we want to be part of that conversation. So maybe it was in part a challenge. We could have held it on a grass-based ranch or something like that, but it felt important to hold it in the place where people are having those kinds of conversations on the production side. And so that's one of the primary reasons we chose it.
Yeah, I think this was a lot about kind of breaking out of silos. So in part that was for us, you know, as a New York-based newsroom, we do try to get out as much as we can, but that, you know, a lot of our coverage, unfortunately, skews towards the sort of Northeast corridor because that's where we are. So a big part of it was like, let's get out of our own little bubble of New York City and go somewhere really different and see what the concerns are there and just talk to people. I think that was part of the genesis. But it was also about, you know, not trying to set up a venue where people are preaching to the choir. You know, you go to a lot of food events and everyone's kind of already on the same team. And this is really not that. The guy we have who's the president of the Cellular Agriculture Society, he's like, we've kind of been joking. We're like, do you have your security detail? Like, are you good? And you know, it's a joke, but really this event represents people from really different factions, from who have really different, approaches to what meat should look like, what agricultural production should look like, what the world should look like to a degree, and I think that's a little challenging and uneasy, you know, in some ways, and it's not what you often get at a food conference. But I think what's exciting for us is to get these people in the same room, having them have discussions where they're, you know, there may not be so much common ground at first, and maybe they'll find some, or at least we think there'll be some really worthwhile conversations.
And I should say, like, contradiction and conflict is what we sort of live for, right? So food conferences can often be a little bit benign. And so we gave a lot of thought to, like, what would a new food economy food conference actually look like? Well, it would look like the kinds of stories we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so we like to be in the center of that narrative where folks are trying to hash out these complicated ethical questions and complicated production questions.
Yeah, and, you know, in a way, I think it was necessary. This is our first sort of bigger event, but... you know, we're not an advocacy publication. And I think that's something when people are sort of familiar with, you know, is a lot of food media, especially on the nonprofit side, sort of skews towards a specific sort of viewpoint. And we really don't do that. I mean, we want to make sense of it all. We want to include different viewpoints. We want to be as objective as possible. And I think this event is really in that spirit, you know, of just convening a bunch of different voices and kind of letting them jostle together the way we do on the page.
I'm excited. I wish that I could be there because I am sure there's going to be a lot of passionate viewpoints.
That is what we're hoping for.
Yeah.
We will have failed if that's not what happens.
Well, based on... So, Kate, last year, you were part of an event at the Slow Food Nations Leadership Summit, I believe it was a summit, yes. And it was a sort of similar topic. It was meat. It was part of... You guys did a meat month last year. And there were a lot of different people in that room. There are a lot of different people involved in slow food. You had someone, I believe, from Neiman Ranch... who has a very, you know, they're a bigger farming operation, some very firmly held viewpoints, and you had people who are kind of on the more, like, regenerative agriculture purist point of view. And although it's, you would think it's Slow Food Nations, everybody's on the quote-unquote same team, but even within that, there's a lot of differing opinions, and I can't imagine that room compared to, like, a land-grant university where you have, like, very old school type of this is how we farm, this is how we'll always farm. But on that note, do you want to talk a little bit more about Meat Month and kind of what that was about?
Yeah, and that was interesting because it was somewhat more on the consumption side. So that originated from a project that we did with the cookbook author, Lynn Curry from the Northwest, who'd written us a cookbook actually on kind of grass-fed and how to cook with grass-fed beef. And we got friendly and she pitched a story about the conscious carnivore conflict, essentially. And I said, you know, let's do it, but let's do it as though we're looking into everything that people bring to the table, literally, when they're consuming meat of any kind. And what, you know, the ethical issues, the labeling issues, the pricing issues. And let's kind of pick 5 case studies across the country. So she did this, you know, extraordinary amount of kind of focus grouping and finding the right prototypical meat eater people who were dealing with an ethical issue and how they had figured out how to do it and how to deal. You know, that from everything from total abstention to I eat it and I'm not distressed about it. That piece was the beginning of a month's worth of coverage on meat that we looked at from every angle. We looked at the myth of grass-fed labeling, not that it's not accurate, but that it doesn't necessarily convey what we think. Joe's looking at me because Joe wrote that piece. You know, when we did Q&As with experts and we brought folks in to just host the conversation for a month in July, and we pegged it to our appearance at Slow Food Nations where we had a similar conversation. And you're very right in the sense, I really didn't know what to expect because that's a high kind of, you know, those folks aren't food curious. They're like food intense. And so I didn't know what to expect. And the one thing I remember from that conversation most was that we asked at the beginning what conscious carnivorism meant. And you're right that it was a room full of everybody from, you know, USDA to hyper-specific tiny, tiny, tiny regenerative ag projects. And I remember having this enormous whiteboard in front of me, and it was just full of, you know, conscious carnivorism meant for some people looking at the way we inseminate our animals. Then it was about slaughter methodology that, you know, and I thought we were just going to be sort of touching on the spiritual, heart-centered nature of meat consumption. And it turned out to be like, well, if we're going to call it conscious, it's got to include this and this. So that was the first time that we really had a sense like, okay, this is bottomless, right? And people's questions about it are infinite. And so let's keep probing. And we, you know, meat and the meat processing sector it's almost a kind of sub-beat for us. We cover it a lot. And those stories deeply interest people for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
So we continue having that conversation. And when it came time to host an event, it was like, let's do this again. What happens. Yeah, exactly.
It seems like a good microcosm for talking about a lot of, like what you were saying, that more and more recently food news is tying in with every other kind of news, whether it's weather, political. And so especially with the climate change issue, I mean, I think it's like it's got this emotional core that kind of gets to the heart of how people feel about a lot of other issues.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's really like, I think that was very eye-opening for us. So just... you know, a lot of the food journal traditionally, you know, it's been like eat this, not that. And I think sort of intuitively, we've always tried to stay away from that because we're journalists, not advocates, and we don't want to tell people to do. But for me, what was so eye-opening about this experience was just how just the wonderful subjectivity of everybody's specific personal decisions and how each person had really just kind of found their own way to make sense of like the messy prospect of meat eating. And, you know, some people had welfare issues. Some people had specific agricultural methodology issues. I remember one woman stood up and with tears in her eyes was like, I just can't afford to buy the thing I know is right. What do I do with that? And so I think it's become a real part, I think, of what we try to cover is not just the methodology and the differences between them that we try to lay out those things as objectively as we can. We also try to include in what we write about the sort of human experience of navigating these intensely fraught emotional issues of trying to eat well, whatever that means for you. And I think, you know, we think that that's a subject that's really worthy of attention and focus, and it's something that we really care about. So this was a wonderful opportunity for us to do that and just get a room together of people to talk about like all their freaky meat issues, you know? Which I think we have many.
Freaky meat issues. Yeah. Oh my God.
Freaky meat.
That should be the title of a new show.
That's
yeah.
a dance party for sure.
One thing that I think ties in kind of to this is specifically kind of how climate change is affecting a lot of the farmers. And you guys do an excellent job of covering that. One of the most recent ones is a story featuring a story about what's happening in Nebraska right now. For people who maybe aren't keeping a close tab on the middle of the country, the Corn Belt, can you guys talk a little bit about what's going on in Nebraska?
Yeah, I would say swiftly moving is the way to describe that story. I mean, essentially, you know, an unusually, insanely cold winter in the Midwest had, you know, left behind really intense snowpack. And that was true in South Dakota. It was true in Nebraska. It was true in Iowa. And for Nebraska in particular, recent rains that were more than the usual amount, which could have been, you know, absorbed by the soil in any other time, kind of prompted just an absolute deluge of flooding. And, you know, it's been true. So there are, God, We just covered this afternoon in news, actually, right now. Still enormous number of counties in Iowa that are declared disaster areas. But what Nebraska is facing in particular is a colossal amount of damage to the agricultural sector, to agricultural infrastructure, grain silos, storage, and also to the roads and highways, certainly. 200 miles, we reported this afternoon, 200 miles of roadways have been destroyed in Nebraska. And railways. So it's affecting kind of absolutely every aspect of moving food in and out of the country, not to mention damage to homes and lives lost. And it's expected to possibly continue. I mean, certainly the recovery will be intense, but I think over the next few days, they're expecting more rain.
Wow.
So that's a quickly moving situation.
And it's the time of year, you know, of course, where the decisions that farmers make and the weather that they experience, you know, significantly impacts the rest of their season and their, you know, their ability to plan or whatever they're going to harvest. And so the thought seems to be that this could be really impactful, not just to, you know, the economics of the sort of agricultural heartland, but to, you know, the amount of food we've got on hand, you know, this time around. So we'll see, but it's a pretty dramatic situation.
Yeah, definitely. So on that note, let's take a quick break. Let's top off our wine glasses.
Yes.
And then we're going to come back, talk about a few more of the things going on at New Food Economy, and then play a little bit of trivia. So we'll be right back.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio has plenty more. Hi, I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I'm the host of Feast Your Ears here on HRN. My show explores the world of food through storytelling. Every week, I talk with people inside and outside the food world about how experience has shaped what they eat and cook. You can find Feast Your Ears wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Thank you, Roberta's. Woo! We love Roberta's.
We love you.
All right, we're back with Kate Cox and Joe Fassler. Another story that I want to talk to you guys about that's kind of part of a bigger issue is you guys wrote about the Roundup lawsuit and the fact that
the jury found it to be, I don't know if it was a judge or jury found it that it was a carcinogenic and that it was directly responsible for one farmer's
Non-Hodgkin's
lymphoma. Yeah.
So let's talk about that. And I also want to ask about other lawsuits happening in North Carolina where they have found that it is the farmers, like the CAFO farmers' fault that the pollution caused by the CAFOs are like a direct threat to people's health. So do you guys see this being part of like a larger trend of lawsuits actually working in favor of people affected by negative farming practices?
Oh, wow. The optimistic side of me says yes, but you know I should hedge a little bit by saying that for every one of these lawsuits that is somewhat unprecedented in its outcome, for instance, there's an equal one on the other side that's upholding or putting caps on nuisance damages or upholding ag gag laws in a particular state. So it's, you know, that's the paradox of the food system, I guess. Claire, our staff writer Claire said yesterday as we were covering the news of the finding in the Roundup trial, I didn't think we'd ever see this in our lifetime. And that stuck with me. Like, that's been sort of in my brain rattling around for 2 days thinking about that. That it is true accountability. To start, it's still, you know, that this is really, really early stage of something like 11,000 lawsuits in the pipeline related to glyphosate-based weed killers and the effect it might be having on public health. But I do think that there are, that we are equally in an age of accountability as much as we are in a post-fact and post-truth age. You know, that there are two forces pushing together that I think we can see, and the food system is an incredible place where those kind of play out for us. So I think there's as much demand for public health accountability, especially, as there might be for keeping things exactly the way they are and making sure that the law supports that. I don't know. What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously, precedent is a big thing when it comes to the law, and you know, even to some of these civil suits. And I do think that both cases have the potential to really open the floodgates. I mean, that does seem to be happening in North Carolina, you know, with these nuisance suits about the smells and just the, you know, the horror of living, you know, in some of these locations. So I don't really know what's going to happen. I mean, one of the experiences that I had, this was, I think, last year, listening to a public hearing in North Carolina about whether they should proceed with some legislation having to do with this. And it was so interesting to hear how divided the local politicians were. You know, you had people who were coming up and saying, you know, my constituents, they can't breathe, they have asthma, they can't sell their homes, they're trapped. And then you had people, you know, also coming up and saying, like, literally, the smell of pig manure is the smell of freedom. That's something that I heard somebody say, like, this Oof. Is America. This is economic opportunity. This wow. is everything it's we progress. Stand for, yeah, you know? And so progress. When you take two positions that are so just freighted and, you know, just not willing to back down, it really, almost anything can happen. I think there's so much money involved. There's so much at stake. And I think it's really anyone's guess, but I do think that, that some of these, you know, legal successes we're seeing are kind of unprecedented. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, I covered in Iowa a lot of people, who had tried to launch these lawsuits unsuccessfully, having to do with egg production there and, you know, flies bombarding their houses and just having to live in stench all the time. And they really weren't able to be compensated the way they thought that they should be. But this does seem to be sort of a new development, and, you know, we'll be watching it really closely to see what happens.
A very recent thing that happened that I thought was interesting was I was listening to an episode of Pod Save America, and they're doing a really good job trying to get, like, great interviews with a lot of the candidates running in the Democratic primary. And Cory Booker, they interviewed him recently, unprompted, he brought up the situation in North Carolina with CAFOs and talking about how the complexity of actually these two people are against each other, but really they're all part of one system that's not working for anybody. I thought that was very interesting, and I'm interested to see if that continues to be a part of his platform and anyone else's platform, how they're going to talk about food. On that note, the Green New Deal is a big thing. I'm not sure how much you guys have covered that lately and or how that might be playing into upcoming elections, upcoming politics. Any thoughts or things you can talk about as far as Green New Deal coverage?
You know, we had a lot of editorial discussions about this. We did not cover it right out of the gate, in part because it's not formal legislation. It's a resolution. And what it really serves as is a sort of, you know, in my view at least, this, it serves as a kind of manifesto for what is quickly becoming very clearly the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And that's a good thing in the sense that their messaging is clear. I'm a policy wonk, so I always want to know, what's it going to look like to reduce carbon emissions to zero in 10 years? You know, like, I mean, these things have to be aspirational in nature, and they have to be enormous in scope. It's sexy, you know, the sexy candidates are involved in it, the sexy Congress people are involved in it. But we haven't covered it in earnest because there's not a lot to say about it more than just here are the four or five kind of bullet points on this. But I'm glad you brought up Cory Booker, because he's really been interesting to us in the sense that, well, first of all, I don't know how you can become a candidate for the 2020 election without discussing agriculture, climate change, food, access, you know, the war on welfare, all of that. But Booker has made it a really stated intention that a significant part of his platform is going to be about antitrust and consolidation in the agriculture industry. That's subversive. I mean, whether it goes anywhere or not, it's subversive. And kind of pulling back the veil on who owns what and acquainting Americans with the massive power block in the center of the country is pretty unusual. That's not the kind of thing we're used to hearing from candidates. So I'm psyched. I'm psyched in the sense that, good, finally ag is on the table in a different way. As, you know, I mean, we live for that. But I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, there's a Heartland Forum in Storm Lake, Iowa, at the end of this month that is specifically looking at antitrust, corporate consolidation, and that's fascinating. You know, I think so. We're sending a reporter out there, I hope, to kind of take the pulse there a little bit and get a sense of how much we might be looking to hear more about this as we lead up to 2020.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'm really excited. I mean, we were just starting out with the publication in 2016, but we had a fairly sleepy 2016, you know, when through the lens of politics, at least, food was really not a big part of the conversation, almost shockingly absent from the conversation. Even climate, you know, was not a major part of it. And that's obviously really starting to change. Obviously, the Green New Deal, it's going to be a big part of the debate. But I even think agriculture specifically is going to be part of it. And I think Cory Booker is a good example of a candidate who's done some really interesting work, proposing bipartisan legislations with people like Senator Mike Lee, you know, about
from Utah.
You
have to say that,
yeah, about you know this issue of consolidation. And so, we've long thought, wow, there's a real political opportunity here to sort of bridge gaps between the urban centers and the agricultural heartland if you're willing to talk about this issue of agribusiness monopolies. And people can really see eye to eye on that. We know it from talking to sources, but I think there's some savvy politicians, Booker among them, who are going to really try to take advantage of that. And I think that could be very interesting for the American political scene.
And it's easy for them to draw parallels. I have to say that too, because the conversation about tech, the power of the tech giants in this country, Amazon, Google, that's something that almost any American has to be versed in at this point if you're living on Earth. So it's very easy to make parallels between the dominance of American tech companies and the opacity of them, and to say to people, even if you're not familiar with the agriculture industry or you don't think about it at this level, understand that meat processing is dominated by four companies in this country. They control almost all of meat processing. And getting people to think about it through the lens of the tech giants and these conversations that we're having about how much power is too much power for an American corporation is If I was Booker's campaign manager, I would be saying that. Here's the messaging. Yeah.
And then also China's influence. He kind of hinted at that. And I mean, especially in relating to North Carolina, the insane influence that China has over our pork industry, I don't think maybe a lot of people are totally aware of. And I think that if he continues to talk about that with what, everything else going on with China, will be very interesting to hear.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. My friend Doug Bach-Clark wrote a great piece for Rolling Stone about this very issue, and his take was kind of like, China's exporting its environmental destruction to the U.S. Like, they, like the Smithfield, Smithfield's own, is Chinese-owned. The practices in terms of lagoons and stuff that they use in the U.S., they won't use in China.
Absolutely.
So the worst of their practices are actually coming here. I mean, to me, that seems like an incredibly politically potent thing to talk about.
We covered that a little bit on Meat and Three. It's been a while, but
I think it's time to circle back because it's becoming more and more.
It really is. And we're just going to pair that with Newark and Cory Booker and
swine fever. Throw that in. Get that in the mix.
Zombie deer and swine fever. Yeah. What's next? Okay, really quick before we jump into trivia. Another Meat and Three story that we did recently was our independent grocery store piece. And Joe, I wanted to ask you, you were in that story, but is there anything on the radar for independent grocery stores? Anything new and exciting you've heard about? Obviously, the Amazon news was very interesting, and Amazon is not coming to New York City anymore. Any ideas on how that will be good or bad for independent grocers in the city?
Yeah. So this is something I've been thinking a lot about. I have a big piece coming out that we're co-publishing with Longreads about the an architect. He calls himself a supermarket ghostwriter, and his clients are small, you know, independent grocery chains with, you know, maybe from 4 to 5 stores to, you know, 20 or 30 stores, and it's all about how he thinks they're going to survive by really doing everything Amazon can't do, which is focus on people. You know, the one store that I visited had like basically had a living room, it had like a game room with like board games and, you know, a full restaurant and all of these things. It's like focus on the experiential aspects of what brings food together. And I think the grocery stores that survive are going to kind of start looking more and more like food halls. Mm-hmm. And so that's a trend that, you know, this piece is really talking about. I do believe that there's some potential there for them to kind of serve as these communal gathering places. If they mm-hmm. think of themselves not just as a place to sort of stock up, you know, and perform a chore, but as places to gather and delight in food and that kind of thing. So that's where I think there's some hope there. I think I've seen some success with that. But the industry is changing extremely quickly. I mean, you've probably seen, or you may have seen the news, the Wall Street Journal reported that Amazon is actually launching a new grocery store, yes. not Whole Foods. And actually part of their strategy, it said in that article, was to just buy up existing small regional grocery chains. So that's where the locations are going to come from. So the challenges are vast. Amazon's sort of, you know, position in the industry is increasing rapidly. It's going to be really interesting. But if you're an independent grocer, and I talk to these people, they're extremely stressed out.
Oh, absolutely. But I do think there is a lot of potential for them, an opportunity.
Yeah.
And it's interesting about we covered this recently too, the Amazon opening up other grocery stores, is that while Elizabeth Warren is saying, I want to break up the trust and roll back the merger, if they open up their own grocery stores that are not Whole Foods, how does that play into that? There's a lot to think about.
Yeah.
A lot to think about. Again, that's not like that's proposed, but, you know, if Elizabeth Warren wants to do it, then maybe she'll do it. So
I'll have to have another glass of wine and just like take that in.
Yeah.
Take it with me.
It's interesting.
But I like that there's policy, like thought about policy going in, like, a voice to protect the consumer, because I think so much onus gets put in our like capitalist system, which is kind of falling to pieces. Like, the pressure is put on consumers, like, well, if you don't like the way things are going, like, don't shop at Amazon and don't do XYZ. And it's like,
we don't have a choice anymore.
And so it really is left up to, it has to happen on the policy level. Like, if we are going to protect smaller businesses, if we are going to try to like keep our food system diverse, like mm-hmm. it can't just be up to us as people who are spending, you know, a few hundred dollars a week or whatever shopping for groceries. Like, there's nothing we can do. So it's exciting, but I hope the ball keeps rolling in that direction, that there will be some sort of checks.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. Well, it's that time. We have a couple more minutes left. We're going to play a little bit of trivia in honor of the upcoming Raising Meat Summit, taking place very appropriately at one of the South's finest land-grant universities, and in honor of the NCAA men's basketball tournament.
Oh, God.
Today's trivia is combining a few of my favorite things, and hopefully yours. This is the mascots of the land-grant universities of March Madness.
Ooh. Oh, we're going to fail.
I can tell you already. We're going to tank.
So incredibly hard.
Question number one is about Auburn University, my alma mater, and who just recently won their first round of the March Madness tournament. Auburn University's mascot, Aubie, is known for his animated characteristics such as a strut walk, quick turns, head shakes, and exaggerated pointing. What kind of animal is Aubie?
I'm going to guess chicken hawk.
I was going to say Peking duck, so I guess you're, like, probably closer.
That would be good.
Well, I know, because sometimes I troll you by saying war eagle. Is that... No, that's...
I don't know what that is.
The correct answer is Aubie is a tiger.
Well, that's so straightforward.
That makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, question number two. It's about Purdue University. Contrary to popular belief, Purdue Pete is not the official mascot of Purdue. Instead, it is the Boilermaker Special, which is what Victorian-era machine?
Wow.
Oh, my mother is going to kill me. That's her alma mater. Oh,
Boilermaker.
A Boilermaker.
What did they make in the Victorian era? Clothes?
Boils?
Boils.
That is something they specialized in, actually.
Boils. Boilermaker. I feel like it's a furnace or something like that, but I'm sure that yeah, okay.
Think about a moving noted. Furnace.
Oh.
A train?
Correct.
Whoa. Cool.
Lucky prey.
It's a train. And they like put him on like a truck and they move him around the campus, which sounds bizarre to me.
It's a sort of a sad mascot.
Yeah, inanimate objects.
Like the little engine that could.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Train. Okay. Victorian era train. Yeah.
Question number three is about Michigan State. Michigan State's mascot is the Spartans. In 1943, MSU art professor Leonard D. Youngworth designed a statue for the university of a Spartan, which was cast in what material due to World War II rationing?
Wow.
So it wasn't like a metal because they were using that for other stuff. What did he make his statue out of?
World War II rationing. Clay?
Close. Think about like an army. There's an army of this in, I believe, China.
Oh. Yeah. I would think that would be.
Wait, it's not. Is it porcelain or?
Mm-mm. Plastic?
It's not clay. Oh.
It's like ceramic? It's like a reddish color.
Yeah. I thought that was like clay, though.
Oh, terracotta.
Correct.
Terracotta.
That's right.
Oh, I'm sure that was sturdy. Yeah.
They moved him inside and replaced him with a bronze one, so it would be okay with the weather.
Terracotta. Okay.
Question number four is about Iowa State. The Iowa State Cyclones are the athletic teams that represent the school. But since a cyclone is difficult to depict with a costume, the university's mascot is what bird named Cy?
Ooh. Is it a cardinal?
Correct.
What?
I lived in Iowa for a few years, so I picked that up on some subliminal way.
You did.
Yeah.
Like something red.
I thought that one would be really hard, and you nailed it.
You've gotten two, Joe.
The last one is about the University of Kentucky. The Kentucky Wildcats have three official mascots. Blue is a live bobcat that lives in an education center and does not attend games, because as we know, bobcats are very shy and don't like crowds. The Wildcat...
I'm sure that's the only problem. Antisocial.
The Wildcat is a costumed student who debuted in 1976, and the third mascot is a more recent addition. It's also a costumed student and is a more child-friendly Wildcat who, quote, wears his hat backwards, drinks Pepsi, and likes to party. What's his name?
Brocat?
Chad.
No idea. Chad. I'm going to go with Chad. I agree.
We got two votes for Chad.
We're going to let them know that they should change his name to Chad. But his name is, and this is very funny because this is a cat that I had growing up. His name is Scratch.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well, we failed.
The mascots of the Land-Grant Universities of March Madness. And you guys, you won. You may not think you won, but you won.
I feel like it's good preparation for like small talk at the meet summit, though, because you are going to a Land-Grant university.
That's true.
Like,
and we should learn about mascots.
I just learned something about your mascot.
Yeah. Do you know A&M's mascot?
I was terrified you were going to ask because I don't.
It's really
is it the Aggie?
It is. It's
but
an
what
easy
is an
one.
Aggie?
It was a nickname. Actually, Michigan State before they were the Spartans were also the Aggies because it was a very common mascot for agricultural universities.
But what does it look like?
Is it a marble?
It's not a thing.
An ear of corn.
Yeah.
They call themselves the Aggies, but I think that their mascot is like some other animal. I don't know.
Maybe it's an agricultural extension agent.
Yes.
In the end,
He has a clipboard and a hat.
Right.
Yeah,
it's just a tractor
and like a temperature gate. Yeah, a tractor.
Oh man! All right. Well, that's our show.
Yeah.
Thank you to Joe Fassler and Kate Cox from the New Food Economy for joining us and playing my bizarre round of trivia.
This was so fun.
Thanks
for having us.
Come back anytime and keep up the amazing reporting. I don't know what I'd do without it. Genuinely.
Thank you.
Thanks to our engineer, Jeet. Thanks to Hannah Forden, our program manager.
Thank you, Kat.
I'm Kat Johnson, and we will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter.
Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.